Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, as we continue our series called Surrounded, we continue what it meant for the Israelites to begin to rebuild. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Jeremy.
Good morning, South Harbor. My name's Jeremy. Jared crushed the infomercial, didn't you think? Legit. Credit where credit is due. So one little thing, I had a couple of you catch me already. When you go to like set up your new giving on your new South Harbor Church Center account, one thing you're going to notice when you go to link your bank is the church it says you're going to link to, it reads South Haven Harbor Church. We're not moving. It's a weird, complicated legal thing when you're separating an entity from another entity. It's us. It'll all get ironed out in the end. You're in the right spot. Make sense? We good? Again, if you have any questions, we will be here. We'll be here all day. But we're glad that you're here. And before we even jump into this morning, can we just name a happy Mother's Day to the mothers in the room? Moms, legit. Moms, we're super grateful for you, for the men in the room who just remembered or just realized it's Mother's Day. Like, hold your cool, like, control your face. Just make sure you grab flowers on the way home. I did double check. You can DoorDash flowers, so, like, you don't even have to find an excuse to leave the house. You can have them shipped right to you. You're welcome. But moms, you can at least know that we did not forget about you. We decided to give you exactly what you wanted on Mother's Day. Week 4 of a sermon series on the Babylonian exile, right? Like, if there's ever proof that we remembered you and moms, we love you, we get to teach you about Mesopotamian foreign policy, because that is what real love looks like. And so, terrible transition, but that's where we are. We are on week 4 of a sermon series that we're calling Surrounded. When we're kind of holding two images side by side, we are looking at the event of the Babylonian exile. Babylon comes in, they lay siege to Jerusalem. We're looking at the exile. And at the same time, we're kind of looking at those moments in our lives where things have fallen apart, where we had all these hopes, all these dreams, and what we're experiencing isn't what we thought it would be, and it almost feels like the walls are kind of closing in. And so we're kind of holding these two kind of side by side. And so we are week 4, which means week 1, we started by looking at kind of what happened before the attack. Before Babylon comes, were there warning signs? And we looked at the prophets, and the prophets were often naming that, like, this is the direction you're going. And if you don't turn, if you don't change, this is where the story's heading. And what we find is they found it's always easier just to keep going down the path you're on than to do the hard work of making deep, real change, right? All the fitness equipment on Facebook Marketplace in February, March proves this is true, right? For the Israelites, they decided we're just going to keep going the direction we're going. And so it went the direction they were told it was going to go. Week 2, we looked at the actual, like, the moment of the attack. Babylon has come, they laid siege, which basically means they cut the city off from its life sources, from its water, from its food. When you lay siege to a city, things should go pretty quickly. We looked at earlier, about 100 years earlier, a king had done some things to make it last a little bit longer in this one. Week 3, last week, we looked at the, like, after the attack, when Babylon comes in and they take all the who's who, all of the important people. Especially if you're in an age that benefits them, they would take you and remove you from your home, from Jerusalem, and they drug you off to Babylon. If you were too young, if you were too old, if they looked at you and decided you weren't really of service to them, they would kind of do away with you. But everybody who they saw as a benefit, somebody who could help Babylon, they would draw into Babylon, take from Jerusalem, bring into Babylon, and then you kind of undergo this brainwashing. Daniel is one of these, trying to thoroughly make you Babylonian. But we saw that even though they get carried off, God was not done with them. God had not forgotten them. We looked at one of the most popular verses. It's especially right now, we're on graduation, the verse that'll end up on probably three quarters of your graduation cards, right? Jeremiah 29, as the people are carried off into Babylon, says, this is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you, not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future. And so this morning, we're going to go to like the next step. The next stage. And so we are going to be, if you want to follow along, we're going to be in Daniel 4, a little bit of Daniel 5, but we'll be kind of right in Daniel. But we're going to be looking at the rebuilding. Because the people do not spend forever in Babylon. They are going to have a moment when they're able to come back. And the question is, what do they do when they come back? What does it look like to rebuild for us when we're in those moments when life has fallen apart, when we're not where we thought we were going to be, when life hasn't gone how we thought it was going to go? How do we in those moments rebuild? What do you do when you're in a space when you thought the relationship was going to look one way and you find yourself in a spot where it looks very different? Or you had an idea for your career, what you were going to give yourself to, and you find yourself in a spot where your reality doesn't look like what you had hoped for, and you find yourself in a space where you're trying to figure out what does it mean to be faithful in this moment? What does it mean to move forward? How do I live here? And in order to answer that, I want to start by asking a question. There's kind of a question that kind of goes behind the entire story for me. It's a question that's kind of behind the whole thing. And it's when Babylon comes in and defeats Jerusalem, the question I think behind the story is, why do they bother to bring everybody back to Babylon? Right? You're Babylon. You've come in. You've destroyed Jerusalem. You brought down the wall. You've destroyed the temple. Why go through all the hassle of identifying who the who's who is and pulling them all the way back to Babylon? Why even bother with it? And in order to answer that question, I think there's another question behind that question, that why bring people back to Babylon? There's another question behind it, which every dominating empire, if you're the power, you're the people who are going to come in and dominate, you're going to defeat. The question, as the leader, that you're always asking is, how do you keep the people that you've conquered in line? Because your job is to try to keep the people you've conquered from trying to rebel, from trying to fight back. How do you do it? You're Babylon. You've defeated Jerusalem. You bring, like, how do you keep them from constantly trying to fight against you to regain their independence? And what we find in kind of ancient Mesopotamian history, in our Old Testament, is there are a few different strategies that empires would take to try to answer that question. How do you keep people in line? So if we take the nation of Israel, under David, King David, King Solomon, the nation of Israel is one nation. After Solomon, it's going to split. You have the north and you have the south. You have 10 tribes in the north. You have 2 tribes in the south. We are looking, the Babylonian exile is going to be the south. But before we get there, I want to start with those 10 tribes in the north, okay? 10 tribes in the north are going to be defeated by Assyria. And Assyria had an answer to the question, how do we keep people in line? Assyria, the way they answered the question was, you keep people in line through a process I'm going to call assimilation. So if you're taking notes, right, Assyria, assimilation, that what Assyria said is, if we take you, we conquer you, we defeat you, we bring you back to Assyria, Assyria knows you still have a place that you call home, right? When you think of your homeland, where you came from, you have a place that you remember, that you still sing songs about, that you dream about. And so Assyria realized, the way to keep you from fighting back, the way to keep you in line, is essentially in the way of assimilation, is to try to take you as an Israelite, as a Jewish Israelite, and try to make you Assyrian. So to say it in maybe the most PG, PC way possible, they would like force intermarriage between the Assyrians and the Jewish people they brought into Assyria. Because when we bring you into Assyria, you're fully Jewish. You have a homeland. Your homeland is Israel. This is where you want to go back to. But if we can make it so your kids are half Assyrian, half Jewish, and then their kids are like a quarter Jewish, three-quarter Assyrian, and we continue to make you Assyrian, eventually, they said, your people will get to a spot where they don't even consider Israel home anymore because Assyria is now your home. Does this make sense? I think for me, I actually make sense of this if I look at my own kind of family tree. Anybody ever do like an ancestry.com thing? Where like somebody shipped you a thing, you're like, sure, I'll give you my DNA. I did that a few years ago. And so I don't know why I did that a few years ago, but I did that a few years ago. And so my ancestry.com is that map right there. So I am like 81% from the Netherlands. Shocking. I paid like $30, got a thing, gave somebody my DNA, because how does that go wrong? And then they gave me this thing back and said like, you're from the Netherlands or Germany? And I said, I always knew that. What else did you give me? And they said, thank you for your $30. And I got a cool map. So at some point, my like great, 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 I don't even know how many greats because I don't know who in my family line came from there. When they jump on a boat, at some point, one of my great, 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 whoever that is, got on a boat, came here. When they came here, where do they think of when they think of home? They think of wherever we actually came from, right? Like, and so there's always this, like, we live here, but like home is back there. And then they have a kid, and like, there's probably a couple generations where it's like, man, if we could, it'd be great to go back and see where our people came from, whatever that means. And then you get to the point where like, you're me, where do I call home? Not that. I grew up here. This is my home. This is where I live. Like, I'd like to see some, I don't even know that I need to go there. But if I did, it's not because like, that's where my people are from, right? Like, this is where my people are from. This is where I am. And so I would say, my people, like I've been assimilated. Does this make sense? Like this is my home. So what Assyria said is if we can do that to the Jewish people, where we bring them into Assyria, we water down their bloodline. So eventually they don't even consider home because this is their home. This is your home. You're not from there. You're from here. You're one of us. And so we actually have a name for these people. Our Bibles have a name for these people, the Israelites who have kind of intermixed with the Assyrians. And now this kind of like, in the Jewish eyes, this kind of watered down version of this ethnic group. Anybody know what we call these people? Samaritans. They're less than, they're other, they're not like us. So Assyria said, how do you keep people in line? You assimilate them, you make them one of us. That's the 10 tribes in the north. It's kind of why the 10 tribes, we consider them the lost tribes. They kind of go away because they become something else. The lower two tribes, these are the ones that we're kind of following in our series. And they're asking the question, the people who come in and conquer are asking the question, how do we keep them in line? Assyria said assimilation, Babylon, who's going to conquer the southern kingdom, these southern two tribes, Babylon had a different strategy. They didn't use assimilation. The word I'm going to use for Babylon is enticement. What they did, what Babylon said, is we want to so wow you by who we are as Babylon that you would never want to leave. You're from these small villages in the hills. Like, if we bring you to Babylon and we show you all of the advantage, like how amazing Babylon is, we can so wow you by us that you wouldn't, why would you ever want to fight against this? And this is a strategy they started right away when you got there. When you got to Babylon, literally the thing you would walk through is the Ishtar Gate. That is the Ishtar Gate. They found it in Babylon. It was kind of in the era of excavation where an archaeologist from Germany found this in Babylon in kind of the early 1900s. And he did what archaeologists did when they found really cool things in the early 1900s. He boxed it all up and he brought it home. So if you want to see the Ishtar Gate, it's not in Babylon, it's in Berlin. But that is the Ishtar Gate. So when you show up in Babylon, it's this massive, from the moment you show up, you realize this is not like where I came from. Babylon is huge. Babylon is impressive. The king of Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, his goal was to essentially make Babylon this wonder of the world. We actually have, there's an inscription on that gate. So what they found in the dirt, the inscription is about 30 feet wide by 50 feet tall. So like he wanted you to see this. And one of the pieces of the inscription says, he's bragging about his accomplishments just within the gate. I placed wild bulls and ferocious dragons, as if there's another kind of dragon, right? Like Puff the Magic Dragon would look very different on that gate. in the gateways, and thus adorned them with luxurious splendor so that mankind might gaze on them in wonder. Look at what I've done. Look at what I've created. Through Babylon, we found inscriptions of Nebuchadnezzar naming things like this. I've made Babylon a wonder of the world. If we defeat you, we conquer you, we're doing you a favor. Because you no longer have to live back there. We're going to bring you into Babylon, and why wouldn't you want this? We actually see kind of an echo of this in our story. In Daniel chapter 4, we read this. It says, all this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? Look at what I've done. Assyria was assimilation. Babylon was, we want to entice you. We want to wow you. We want you to so fall in love with the way of Babylon, you would never want to leave. Now, there's a saying that we often say. You probably know it. It's the whole idea that, like, pride comes before. Daniel 4 is Nebuchadnezzar going, look at everything I've created. Now, there's a lot that happens between Daniel 4 and Daniel 5, but literally you flip the page, and Daniel 5, we read these words. It says, he carried into exile to Babylon, this is the remnant, who escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and his successors until the kingdom of Persia came to power. Babylon, all that is Babylon, mighty, powerful Babylon, is going to fall. And it's going to fall to the empire of Persia. Let's keep reading. It says, the land enjoyed its Sabbath rests. All the time of its desolation it rested until the 70 years were completed in fulfillment of the word the Lord spoken by Jeremiah. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put into writing. So a proclamation he puts into writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of his people among you may go up, and may the Lord their God be with them. So King Cyrus, we also know him as Cyrus the Great. As an aside, I love how many people just like added the great to the end of their name in the ancient world, right? Like we have Herod the Great, we have Alexander the Great, we have Cyrus the Great. You dominate some people, apparently you're great. So Cyrus the Great, Cyrus does something new. Cyrus, in our story, it says they defeat Babylon. Cyrus is now the guy in charge. And in our story, it says Cyrus allowed the people to go home. And he didn't just allow them to go home. Like, he sent the things that Babylon had taken out of the temple when they destroyed the temple, he sends back home with the people. It says, did you notice that it says that he made a proclamation and he put it in writing? Any guesses what archaeologists have found from Cyrus the Great in the ground? In Babylon, we found this thing. It's called the Cyrus Cylinder. And it doesn't exactly mirror our biblical text, but on the Cyrus Cylinder, this is what it says. It says, I, Cyrus, returned to these sacred cities on the other side of the Tigris, the sanctuaries of which have been in ruins for a long time, the images which used to live therein, therein is a great word, and established for them permanent sanctuaries. I also gathered all their former inhabitants and returned to them their habitations. The Cyrus cylinder is this like brand new document where Cyrus literally put into writing that all of the people that Persia had controlled, had dominated, all of the people who had gotten pulled out of their homelands, Cyrus allowed to go back home. So the question, why does Cyrus let the Jewish people go home? Why write the Cyrus cylinder? Why bother with this as a foreign policy? Is it simply because, like, Cyrus was just a nice guy, right? Like, he looked at all these people, and he's like, let's just let them all go home. I would argue Cyrus is also trying to answer the question, right? How do you keep people in line? Cyrus the Great is the head of Persia. He looks at all of these people that Babylon has conquered, that he now is in charge of because he conquers Babylon. And he's asking the question, how do I keep them in line? So if Assyria was assimilate, we make you Assyrian. If Babylon was, we want to so wow you by everything that is Babylon that you'll never want to leave. The word I want to tie to Persia is accommodation. Though what Persia said is, you know what we're going to do? You people, you're from a different place. You have your songs. You have your stories. You have the life that you lived back where you used to live. What we're going to do, how great are we going to be to you? Because what we're going to do is we're going to let you go home. That homeland that you still tell stories about, we're going to let you go. We're not even just going to let you go. We're going to send funding so that you can rebuild the temple that you tell stories about. All we're going to ask in return is your unwavering loyalty and your taxes. So as long as you stay loyal to Persia, and as long as you pay your taxes when your taxes are due, you can go back home and you can live in the land. Aren't we so generous? We are so amazing to you. And so Cyrus will let the people go home. Now, we know that when they return, they don't all just return at once. There's actually three waves that'll come. First one is kind of this leader. The second one is led by a guy by the name of Ezra. Ezra, we have a book in our Bible named Ezra. Nehemiah will come in the third wave. So we know there are at least three. But Ezra, if you read the book of Ezra, Ezra kind of details that journey back. So Ezra chapter 1 is actually like they take an inventory of all of the things that Persia now has that were taken from the temple. And so there's this inventory of like, these are the things we're going to send back. And then Ezra 3 shows when Ezra and his people in that second wave, so it's like 10 years after the first people are able to go back to Jerusalem, Ezra goes with a group of people in the second wave, and Ezra 3 describes it this way. It says, when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the first thing they do, they want to rebuild the temple. The priests in their vestments and with trumpets and the Levites, the sons of Asaph with cymbals, took their places to praise the Lord as prescribed by David, king of Israel. With the Lord and thanks, with praise and thanksgiving, they sang to the Lord, he is good. His love towards Israel endures forever. And all the people gave a great shout of praise to the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. And then these words are heavy. But many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple, who wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid, while many others shouted for joy. No one could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping, because the people made so much noise and the sound was heard far away. The people come back. They start the foundation of this rebuilding of the temple, and we have joy and we have weeping hand in hand, so loudly it says you could not distinguish between the two. Why? Why? When they're able to come home, they're rebuilding the temple. Why do the priests weep? Well, what we find in this return is you have two groups of people. You have the people who are younger. They were maybe born in Babylon. They were born during the time they were under the control of Babylon and Persia. They've not seen the former Jerusalem. They weren't there when the temple came down. They'd heard stories of it. And now they get to go back to Jerusalem. They're now in Jerusalem. And to them, we're home and we're starting something brand new. But among them, you have some people who were not born in captivity. They weren't born as slaves. They were born prior to. They remember. They were there when Assyria laid siege, or when Babylon laid siege. They were there when the walls were broken in. They were there when the temple comes down. They remember the noises. They have visions of the temple on fire, of all, everything they held dear. They have memories of it all coming down. For 70 years, they've been in Babylon, and they've been dreaming of this possibility that maybe one day God will bring us home. And when God brings us home, like we'll get to rebuild what was, and we'll get to start over. And for 70 years, they've held on to this dream and this hope and this prayer. And then the day comes when Cyrus says, "You can go." And we read it in the story. They just come from Babylon or Persia back to Jerusalem. This is not a short journey. If we look at it on a map, Babylon is over to the right. Jerusalem's on the left. Do you notice the color between Babylon and Jerusalem? Brown. You don't walk through the desert. What you do, you can kind of see a river going up. You follow the Euphrates, and then you come back down. The trip from Babylon to Jerusalem is somewhere around 900 to 1,000 miles. In their world, you're doing this by foot, right? There is no Amtrak. Amtrak? That's weird. But you're walking. This journey is going to probably take you somewhere in the vicinity of 4 months. So for 4 months, you're walking back home with all of the dreams, all of the prayers. We're going to go back and we're going to get to rebuild. And then what happens is they get back, and in the place where the temple was, they see this foundation that's being laid. And imagine these priests who had seen the prior temple, they step back and they see the foundation that's currently being laid, and they start running some equations in their head, and they realize what they're building is going to pale in comparison to what was. That we know the temple they're going to rebuild is going to be smaller, it's going to be less impressive. And it feels like for the older priests, they had 70 years they've dreamt about this moment. For 4 months, they've walked home thinking they're actually going to step into that prayer. And now they look at what's being rebuilt and they realize this is not what was, and they weep. And the story, I think, does something important there. That the story doesn't tell them that they were wrong to weep, that they shouldn't have wept, that the grief was wrong. It simply tells us that they wept. Because the thing of it is, grief is not the opposite of faith, right? Grief, their weeping, is not a sign of a lack of faith. Grief is what happens. I think grief is what happens when we're honest enough to name that we've lost something, and that the something we lost was real. And in our story, I think it also shows us, I think, something important about grief. Because I think we often think about grief in terms of things that we had that we lost. And that is true. There is grief there. When you have something and you lose it, there is grief. But I think there's another type of grief that is often, it's harder to name. Maybe it's harder to articulate. It's harder to name. It's probably not something we talk about as much as we should. And it's the grief for the life you hoped for, but did not get to live. That you had this dream, you had these hopes, and the reality that you're living in doesn't look like the reality you thought you were going to live in. And there is a loss associated with that that I think our story says it's okay to grieve. That it's you had hopes, you had dreams, you had, maybe it's around relationship. And you had these hopes and dreams of where you would be right now in this phase of your life. And when you step back, you realize you're not where you thought you would be or where you hoped you would be. I think it's this is something that maybe some of us feel, especially on a day like today, on Mother's Day, right? Because there are some of us in the room who wish we had different relationships with mom, right? Your friends had this great relationship, and if you're honest with yourself, you didn't, and what you hoped you could have had, what you would have dreamed for, what you prayed for, is not the reality you got to live. For some of us, we thought we'd be on a different space in the journey of motherhood, right? You thought the relationships would look different, or you thought you would be in a space in regards to having kids, and you're in a space that isn't where you thought you would be. That I do think there's a grief where we have a hoped for, we have a life that we hope for, that we dreamt of, that we did not get to live. And the story says, the story doesn't say that they were wrong to weep. The story doesn't say that they were wrong to grieve. I think what the story warns them of is becoming so attached to either what was or what they hoped would be that they weren't able to be present in their moment or step into the future that God had in front of them. Because I think sometimes the threat that we might walk into is we had the blueprint, what we thought life was gonna look like. And I think sometimes we can confuse that with the actual life that we're living or the future that God has in front of us. And one of the things that could threaten us from stepping into that future is we become so tied to either what was or what we wanted to be that we struggle to step into the actual future God has before us. The older priests, they come back. And what they see is a lesser temple being built, and they grieve. Because all they can see is what was and what they hoped was going to be, and the reality that they stepped into didn't match either. But what they might not have known, what they couldn't have known, is that the foundation that was going to be laid would be the foundation of the temple that when Jesus went to the temple, granted, Herod the Great is going to do a massively remodel on it, but that is the foundation. When Jesus goes to Jerusalem, he enters that temple, that one. They couldn't have ever seen that coming. But I wonder if sometimes we can become so focused, so stuck on what was or what we hoped that we fail to step into what is actually in front of us. It's God will actually meet the people in this space. And God will send a prophet by the name of Haggai, and Haggai will address this with the people. This is what Haggai says. It's in Haggai 1. It says, on the 21st day of the seventh month, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Speak to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, to Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people. Ask them, who of you is left who saw this house, the temple, in its former glory? How does it look to you now? Does it not seem to you like nothing? It's smaller, it's lesser. But now be strong, Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Be strong, Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all of you people of the land, declares the Lord, and work. For I am with you, declares the Lord Almighty. This is what I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, and my spirit remains among you. Do not fear. The new temple, is it less than what it was? Yeah. Yeah. And keep going. Keep working. The word through Haggai isn't, yeah, it's less, and we should all, yes, it's less, and keep building. Don't get so stuck on what you thought it was gonna be, on either what it was or what you thought it was gonna be, that you find yourself paralyzed in this moment, that you stop the work. The grief of what was is real, and that's okay. The grief of what you thought would be is real, and it's okay, but do not stop working. It feels like the word through Haggai is you can grieve what was, or you can grieve the loss of what you hoped would be, but to do it with a trowel in your hand, right? To keep moving forward. That you're in a spot where the relationship, something broke. Something happened somewhere along the way, something broke. And you might think that the way forward is to try to recreate what was. But the reality is what was isn't what is. And you find yourself in the space of like, I don't even know what to do. I think the invitation is that you can grieve what was, you can grieve where is, but to keep a trowel in your hand and to keep moving forward. That the dream you had for yourself of where you'd be in your career or in your stage of life, that you're not where you thought you were going to be. The grief of that is okay, but to do it with a trowel in your hand and keep moving, keep working, keep moving forward. See, I think there's a game that I think we often play with ourselves that keeps us stuck. And it's a game that I'll often call the if-only game. That the way the if-only game goes is we tell ourselves that we would be happy or we would be content or things would be better if only something went different. That if only they wouldn't have said what they did. If only I would have declared a different major in college. If only I would have gotten that job. If only this diagnosis wouldn't have come. If only they didn't. If only I didn't. If things would be different, then I would be happy. Then I would be content. Then things would be good. And the problem with the if onlys is I think the if onlys can keep us so tied into what was or so tied into what we thought we would, where what we thought would be but isn't, that it keeps us from actually being grounded in and living in the moment we're in right now, doing what Haggai encouraged to keep moving forward. So I wonder if the invitation then from the story, from the return of exile, is that again, the grief of what was, the grief of the thing that broke is okay and it's normal. That grief is real. The grief of the life that you maybe hoped for but isn't the life that you're living is okay and it's real. But to keep a trowel in your hand, to keep working, to keep moving forward, to let go of the if-onlys, when we let go of the if-onlys, it allows us to actually be present in this moment. Instead of being focused on all of the things that aren't, we maybe get to open our eyes to all of the things that are, to be grateful for the gifts that God has given, and to step into that future that God has in front of us. I think that's the invitation. Would you pray with me? God, we do pray that you would open our eyes to what's in front of us, to what's around us, even in this moment right now, that in those spaces where it feels like rebuilding is just so incredibly difficult, that we don't even know what it looks like. God, we pray that you would even break it down for us, to even show us just that next right step, that we would do the next right thing, and then after that, again, the next right thing. And God, we just pray that you would help us to let go of the if-onlys, to let go of the death grip we might have on what was or what we thought would be, and that we might release that to you as we step into today. We pray this all in Jesus' name.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org. Or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, we want to wish you a blessed week.